I don't remember much about that first month back at Greyfriars. Not until the morning of what would have been my mother's 18th wedding anniversary with Hugh Fisher, if my stepfather had still been alive. I didn't especially want to sleep in my old bedroom at Greyfriars, but Mama insisted. An elderly watercolorist named Brigitte occupied one bed, and Mama convinced her to allow me the other one, the one I used to sleep in. "It's the best I can do for you, Miranda," she told me, and I tried to explain that I would much rather sleep by myself in one of the smaller, northwest-facing bedrooms, the ones that didn't overlook the Fleet Rock Lighthouse, say. But she closed her ears in that particular way of Mother's, and I was stuck with Brigitte and a vista most people would kill for. But maybe that was no better than I deserved, no more than I'd asked for when I returned to Greyfriars as I had, clandestine and without explanation, like some kind of fugitive. In any case, Brigitte was deaf and had no interest in cinema at all, no regard for actors and fame and gossip, so she kept an amicable silence and never asked a single awkward question. Nor did the sea view trouble me in those early weeks. For most of May, the weather was so terrible, rain after rain, you couldn't see much of the lighthouse, except for the dull, long beam of the light itself. These were mercies, and I was grateful for them. But the 4th of June dawned clear, and the pink glitter of the sunrise woke me in a strange, unquiet mood. I listened to the gentle rumble of Brigitte's snore until I couldn't stand it any longer, and slipped free from the worn white bedspread, the sagging mattress, to make my way to the window, and a sight that puzzled me. There was the lighthouse, of course. Your eyes couldn't help going straight to the lighthouse, sticking up out of that plucky, rocky little island, its white walls all pink with dawn. The tide hung low, exposing the underside of the rocks, and in that flat, uncertain light, a lobster boat seemed to draw away from the ramshackle dock that lay in the lee of the narrow, vicious channel between Winthrop Island and Fleet Rock. I suppose my heart stopped, or something like that. Certainly I felt the shock right in my chest, right where everything vital lives, and I couldn't seem to move. The boat churned quickly to the west, pulling a delicate white wake behind its stern. And as the distance grew between vessel and lighthouse, the life returned to me. I dove for the shelf where I used to keep a pair of binoculars, but of course the binoculars were no longer there. And I went from drawer to shelf to cabinet, searching desperately for binoculars, telescope, anything. In all the fuss, Brigitte woke and demanded to know what was the matter. "Nothing," I said, though I knew she couldn't hear me. Like I said, she was mostly deaf. I went back to the window, but of course the boat was gone. Not even the foam of its passing remained, and I wondered if I had simply imagined it. A hallucination, a ghost, because it was the 4th of June, after all, the anniversary of my mother's wedding to Hugh Fisher. 2. There was no going back to bed after all that, so I put on my bathing suit and went to the pool to swim before breakfast, as I did every morning, even in inclement weather. When I first met my husband, he informed me, in that kind, embarrassed voice of an Englishman telling you an intimate fact, that I needed to lose 10 pounds for the camera. And in order to help me achieve this feat, he drew up a regular program of exercise that I'd maintained ever since, even while pregnant. I did this not to please him, but because it gave me a strength I thought I'd lost, a strength I couldn't find elsewhere. I liked swimming most. I felt fleet in the water, weightless, without substance. I felt as if I had distilled myself back to the essential Miranda. I felt as if I were 18 again, and a boy I worshipped was leaning in close to kiss me. This was especially true inside the swimming pool at Greyfriars, which was filled, now as before, with salt water, not that chlorinated stuff they call fresh. How I relished the pungent, saline tang. I counted off 30 laps, long and steady. And I was just pausing at one end, considering the position of the sun in the sky and wondering if I ought to add on another 5, maybe 10, when I noticed the tall, blonde fellow who stood by the cabana in his swimming trunks, arms crossed against his bare chest, observing me. "Excuse me," I said, "am I in your way?" He unfolded his arms and walked toward me. He had a tremendous young physique, a sturdy, masculine skeleton not quite filled out, limbs straight and golden, and he was smiling. I adjusted the side of my bathing cap and summoned my dignity.
"It's Miranda, isn't it?"
he said, coming to kneel by the pool's edge, about 3 yards away, a respectful distance, and yet familiar. "I'm afraid I don't know whom you mean."
"Ah, Miranda, it's me."
He held out his hand.
"It's your brother. It's Hugh."
3. I remember exactly where I was when I first learned I had a baby brother. I knew he was arriving, of course, or rather it. I knew it was arriving, but still I felt a shock when the Countess laid the newspaper on my breakfast tray and pointed to the relevant item. We were staying in Paris at the time, the Ritz. It was the end of March, and the weather outside the window was bleak and terrible, and I'd caught a nasty cold on the liner. Hadn't been out of bed since we arrived, almost. I remember the soft sheets and the elegant blues and yellows of the room, and the Countess's anxious face as she watched me read the few lines. To Mrs. Hugh P. Fisher of Winthrop Island, New York, and the late Mr. Hugh P. Fisher, a boy. Hugh Percival Fisher, Jr., at the Rhode Island Hospital in Providence, Rhode Island.
"It's a boy," she said quite unnecessarily.
"My brother," I said, in the throaty, rough voice of a bad cold. She took the newspaper back.
"I hope everything went well. It doesn't say anything about their health, mother and baby.
And they're not going to tell us, are they, Isabel or Mama?"
The Countess folded the newspaper, refilled my coffee cup, and kissed my forehead.
"I'll find out the details. Don't you worry. Just rest and get better."
I drank my coffee and sat back on the pillow and thought about this new fact, this new human being, squalling in some bassinet across the ocean, who belonged to me. It didn't seem real. Maybe because I was sick. Maybe because I had endured so much in the previous 7 months, calamity after calamity, until I was simply numb. I could not seem to create a place for him in my brain, in my heart, this living bundle of humanity. He was a theory. My brother, Hugh Fisher, Jr. Of course they named him after my stepfather. They could hardly name him anything else after what happened. I wondered what he looked like, and what kind of personality he had, what kind of man he would be. I remember turning my head to gaze at the rain crawling down the window, the gray Paris landscape beyond, and wondering if I would ever find out. And now here he was. This was what he looked like. This was who he was. A living human being. A teenager. I lost my grip on the pool's edge and flailed to right myself. Hugh dove forward and caught my arm and sort of slid into the pool right next to me. A silly young grin split his face.
"Sorry to sneak up on you like that," he said. "I only just got back last night."
"Got back from where?" I gasped.
"School. St. Paul's. You knew that, didn't you? I know you and Mom write letters."
"Of course I knew that. I understand you're doing well there."
"One more year to go."
"My goodness. I suppose so. You're 17 now." He leaned forward and kissed my cheek.
"Nice to meet you, sister. If you don't mind my saying so, you look a hell of a lot different inside a swimming pool than you do on screen."
"Oh, my goodness," I said. "Hugh."
"Ah, don't cry. It's all right."
There was absolutely no way to embrace him as I clung to the crumbling stone edge of the Greyfriars swimming pool, mastering my shock. For some reason, I still pictured my brother as a kid, about 8 years old, grinning and toe-headed as he appeared in one of the photographs Mama dutifully sent me, once we had begun to write to each other again. Now the white hair had darkened to gold, and only the grin remained of the picture in my head.
"Now you're getting it," he said, rubbing away a tear from my cheek. "Take a deep breath."
"You look like your father."
"So they tell me. Come on, let's get out of the water."
He turned and stroked to the ladder. I watched his confident arms and my eyes began to sting again, so I launched myself after him before I could think. I followed him in a daze, took his hand to help me up, and at last our arms went around each other, an embrace that would have been awkward if Hugh hadn't hugged quite so tight, so wholehearted, as if I really were his long-lost sister. Well, Christ, I was, I thought. I am. "Can't believe it," he said, pulling away to beam at me. "Mom didn't say anything. It was Isabel. She said I could go down to the pool this morning. They'd filled it up finally."
"I filled it up," I said.
"Did you? Hasn't been filled in years. Not since the Fisher stock stopped paying dividends. Mr. Monk told Mom she ought to sell out before the whole company went belly up, but she wouldn't."
He picked up a towel from one of the lounge chairs and tossed it at me, and then he proceeded to the cabana to fetch himself a towel of his own.
"Anyway, Isabel had the old gleam in her eye, if you know what I mean, so I figured something was up. As soon as I saw you, I knew what it was."
"I thought you said I looked different off-screen."
"Well, you do, but you're still Miranda Thomas, you know. Nobody else like you, especially around here. You've got that glow."
"That's just the makeup they give you."
"No, it's not."
He whistled as he toweled himself off.
"The fellows at school don't believe me when I tell them you're my sister. Just wait till I..."
"No, you can't tell them."
"What's the matter?"
I laid my finger on my lips. "I'm not here."
Up went his eyebrows. "Ah, I got you. Incognito. What about the rest of the island, though? Don't they know you're here?"
"I haven't been out yet. I've stayed at Greyfriars."
"Well, I guess if you wanted to hide out somewhere, you couldn't find a better place. Still, no one's going to tell if you head to the club for dinner or something. This is the island, after all."
"Do you still belong to the club?" I thought.
"Mom keeps up the membership somehow, though she never goes."
"Oh, of course. I should have known she would." I tucked the towel around the top of my breasts and sat down on one of the chairs, while Hugh lit himself a cigarette from the pack he seemed to have fetched from the cabana, along with his towel.
"Should you be smoking that at your age?"
"Ah, you won't tell, will you?"
"That depends." He waggled the pack at me.
"Want one?"
"No, thank you. They're bad for your health."
Hugh flung himself on the neighboring lounge chair. "Everything's bad for your health. You might as well live a little. Anyway, I don't do it that often. Just sneak a couple here and there. What's the matter?"
"I can't believe it's you, that's all. I can't believe you're sitting there."
"Neither can I. I mean, I can't believe you're sitting there. Look at you in the flesh. And I just hugged you."
"You were just a theoretical brother. Your mother and I..."
"Our mother, sis."
"We fell out for a few years, around the time you were born, as you know."
"Yeah, I know. At least you patched things up a little, passed the old olive branch between you. And now you're here."
He turned on his side, and he looked so much like his father in that instant, smiling and golden, it shocked me. I had to curl my fingers into my palm, the way I did sometimes on camera or at home, when I thought I could no longer bear the strain of everything.
"I'm here," I said.
"And I'm here. And Mom and Isabel and all the dear old crazies with their easels and pottery wheels. So maybe we can pretend to be a real family for once. At least for the summer, anyway."
"We are a real family." I reached out and touched his arm. "It's wonderful to meet you at last, Hugh Fisher Jr., in the flesh."
"Same to you, Miranda. Miranda Thomas, my famous sister."
"Oh, that. It's just a show, Hugh. Just some stupid films."
"Not stupid at all. It's how I got to know you. I've seen your movies about a million times, you know that?"
I turned away and pulled my legs up to my chin. Above the boxwoods, the sky was fresh and blue, absent of any clouds.
"That's not really me, Hugh. We'll have to do better than that."
"Well, it was the best I could do at the time. I thought about writing, but then I figured I didn't want to bother you or anything. Just some fan of yours."
"Hugh, my God, you're my brother. I'd have been delighted, I really would. I wish you had. I'd have written too, but I thought, well, Mama."
"Yeah, Mom.
She's done a wonderful job raising you. I can see you've grown into a fine boy."
"That's what they tell me." His voice deepened. "You're a fine young man, Hugh Fisher, a credit to your father." I turned my head and saw that he was still looking at me, or maybe beyond me, past the top of my forehead to land on the boxwoods, or the cabana, or the ragged rooftops of Greyfriars looming above all. He had a certain faraway expression. My God, he was handsome. I thought I was used to handsome. I was used to men whose looks arrived from some different universe, some territory of the gods, like Valhalla. But young Hugh Fisher might have had them all beat, and he was just 17. I reached over the gap between us to pluck the cigarette from between his fingers and drop it on the paving stones. Just leave off the cancer sticks, all right? Hugh rolled his lean blue eyes, in the way of teenagers everywhere, and flopped on his back to take in the sun. Whatever you say, sis. 4. I must have dozed off, because I found myself startling awake some time later to discover the empty chair by my side. According to the sun, only a short time had passed, and yet I had the disquieting feeling that I'd lost the entire morning somehow, that I had possibly dreamed the whole episode, that I had imagined Hugh as well, like the lobster boat at dawn. But when I looked down at the paving stone, I saw the spent cigarette lying there where I'd dropped it. I picked it up and ran my finger around the end where his mouth had been, and I thought, my brother. I rose from the chair and tossed the cigarette end into the hedge of enormous overgrown boxwoods that enclosed the pool from view. 18 years ago, as I well remembered, those bushes had been trained into immaculate, square-edged perfection by a fleet of gardeners. Not one of those gardeners remained now. The green lawn, the fragrant roses, the careful perennial borders, all wilderness. I had spent my own money to fill this pool, to pay for the fellow who came once a week to clean it. One patch of cultivation existed, and that was a new patch altogether, a kitchen garden where Mama and Isabel grew the vegetables and herbs that had once come from the grocer in town. Imagine my surprise, then, when I emerged from the cabana, showered and dressed in my caftan, and discovered a small clutch of new June roses on the lounge chair where just a moment ago I'd been sleeping. 5. Also in the way of teenaged boys, Hugh Fisher slept all afternoon and woke at 5 o'clock, wanting to go to the club for dinner and to see his friends. "Certainly you may," said Mama, without looking up from her easel. "Are they expecting you?" "Course they are. It's summer, after all. Everyone's back on the island." He bent and kissed the top of her head. "What are you painting?" "That." She pointed her brush at Brigitta, who perched naked on the low stone wall bordering the terrace, clasping her arms around her legs, leaning her cheek against her bony knees. Brigitta, I should add, was about 70 years old, but she displayed not the slightest sign of embarrassment at her nakedness, as if her sagging, imperfect body did not belong to her at all, or else belonged to all women. Whereas I, in every photograph— not the films, mind you, just the photographs, felt the weight of the camera lens like a brand against each precious inch of exposed skin. Hugh peered at the canvas. "Not bad this time. The angle of her arm, that shadow. You need to work on her face, though." "Faces are the hardest." Hugh straightened and turned to me. The sun hadn't yet fallen behind the ridge of the Greyfriars roof, and he stood there like Apollo with his blonde hair and his tanned face, bathed in light. Sometimes it's astounding, the inequitable distribution of genetic material, those fateful chemical spirals locked in our cells, and the worst thing, or else the best thing, was that he had no idea. No conscious knowledge whatsoever that he, Hugh Fisher, had received such an unfairly vast largesse from nature while the rest of us made do with less. He just smiled, without guile. "Miranda, you coming?" There was a shattering little silence. Even the two chattering sisters on the nearby lawn, oil paint, both of them, seemed to arrest their conversation, and in the quiet, I became aware that Brigitta was humming to herself, a wandering, tuneless tune. Isabel, on the other side of the terrace, looked up from her pile of knitting.
"What did you say, Hugh?"
"I thought Miranda should come to the club with me for dinner tonight."
"Miranda?" The club?
Yeah, the club. Where else can you go for dinner around here?
She can't, Isabel said. Her bruises.
What bruises?
On her face.
Hugh stared at me. She hasn't got any bruises.
Isabel's right, said Mama. Of course Miranda can't go to the club.
Why not?
I tucked my thumb into the crease of my book and said, Because I'm persona non grata around here, don't you know that? I don't dare show my face inside the sacred walls of the club.
Miranda, don't use that tone, said my mother.
She ought to use that tone. It's stupid. Why shouldn't she go to the club?
She's not a member.
She's with me. She's my sister.
For God's sake, Hugh, give it a rest, said Isabel, picking up her knitting again. She can't go, that's all. Maybe it's stupid, but people have long memories around here, and, well, it's the club.
To hell with them, said Hugh. It happened 18 years ago. It was before I was born. She was a kid. And anyway, I don't see what she did that was so bad.
Hugh, snapped my mother. He was your father.
Come on, I've read the old newspapers. I've read the transcripts. I don't get it. What's the big deal? She spent the night with a boy, that's all. It was 1951, not the Middle Ages. You can't blame her for what happened after.
You don't understand, Isabel said.
Mama threw down her brush.
Do you know that the Marshalls were here again today, asking about the Vargas boy?
Marshalls, I whispered, but nobody heard me. Hugh made a noise of interest.
Were they now? Any news?
No, but I'm sure they'll be knocking on all the other doors, disturbing the entire island with their terrible questions, and Miranda's the last person anybody will want to see at dinner after that ordeal.
Ah, Mom, said Hugh. That's not fair. It's not her fault Vargas awarded himself an early release.
Don't be flippant.
I stood up. The world tilted and then righted itself. I glanced out to sea. I couldn't help it. And toward Isabel, staring watchfully, and then my mother.
You're sure there's no news? I said.
My mother pressed her lips together and frowned in Isabel's direction.
No news. There's no sign of him.
I breathed out slowly and smiled.
If you'll excuse me, I'll just go get dressed for dinner.
Miranda!
My mother said, agonized. Hugh, you'll meet me at the front door in, 15 minutes? He jumped to attention and saluted me.
Right on!
On my way back inside, toward the one set of French doors that still opened properly, I crossed behind Mama. As I did, I turned my head to regard the canvas. Like all my mother's paintings, it was abstract and somewhat derivative, borrowing the perspective of a more original mind. Brigitte's body had been rendered in a series of blurred triangles, and the only clear detail was the line of numbers tattooed on her wrist, which Mama painted larger than life. 6. Hugh Fisher might have inherited his father's thick golden hair, but he wore it longer, looser, without all that pomade I remembered, and it tumbled around his head as we sped around the long sunlit curves of Winthrop Road.
So what was Isabel talking about back there, he said. The bruises, I mean.
Nothing. It was nothing. I had a little accident just before I arrived, that's all.
An accident, huh? What kind of accident?
A car accident.
Jesus, are you all right?
I am, obviously. All better now.
Because if that husband of yours gave you those bruises, I'd knock his lights out.
Well, the car gave me the bruises, and I'm afraid its lights are already knocked out.
Jesus, he said again. You are all right, aren't you?
Perfectly fine.
And the husband? Where's he?
Back home in London, as far as I know.
As far as you know?
I have a marvelous idea, Hugh. Let's talk about all your girlfriends, every single one.
He laughed. That would be a short conversation.
Not as short as this one. Hugh whistled.
All right, all right. I can take a hint. Film director husband is off limits, at least until I can get you loaded enough to spill the beans.
In which case, I'll get you drunk enough that you don't remember a word I said.
What? Gosh, Miranda, I'm not even 18 yet. I might have to report you to the police for corrupting the morals of a minor.
From what I've seen so far, there's not much left to corrupt.
Ah, Miranda, stop busting my chops.
I'm your sister, darling. I'm supposed to bust your chops.
Hugh laughed. He seemed to have a sunny nature, my kid brother, God knew why, and reached over to land a swift pat on my knee. You know what? I think I like it.
I made a noise of dismissal and crossed my legs, so that the knee he'd patted was covered over by the other. I wore a simple dress. Simpler is always better, my husband used to tell me, and he was right about that. A short, well-cut sheath of sapphire blue and a pair of low-matching heels, so the knees in question were bare. I'd hesitated upstairs before putting it on. Maybe the dress was too short for the Winthrop Island Club. Maybe the families weren't keeping up with the times. Maybe all the matrons would sneer at me, and all the debutantes would narrow their eyes. Well, they were going to do that anyway, weren't they? Might as well give them something to sneer at. I stared at the gray road ahead, pale in the late sunshine, and I thought I could taste the sea at the back of my throat.
Do you ever think about it? Hugh asked. Or do you just push it out of your mind?
Think about what?
The murder, he said.
I closed my eyes and concentrated on the draft blowing past my cheeks. Hugh's car was a Ford convertible, 10 years old, noisy and fast, most un-island-like. I wondered where he got it and how he'd paid for it. I turned the words over in my head, the murder. And I said, you say that like it wasn't your own father.
Well, I never met him, did I? I have his genes, that's all. I mean, I love him, I guess, the idea of him. But I didn't know him at all.
He paused to shift gears.
How well did you know him?
Not very well. I only met him a few times, actually, when he was courting my mother and then the wedding. Then they went away on their honeymoon and didn't come back until the end of the summer.
When Vargas killed him.
I turned away to stare at the passing bushes, the young trees, far more of them than there were 18 years ago. I'd mentioned this to Isabel a week or so ago, and she said that the seeds apparently blew in during the hurricane of 1938. That's what the scientists said, and now the new growth was finally starting to take hold and spread. One hurricane taketh away, and another hurricane giveth.
Didn't he? Hugh said. Come on, lay it on me. You were there at the lighthouse when it happened.
I don't know. I was asleep, as you must know if you read those transcripts.
But were you really asleep? I always wondered.
I testified under oath, didn't I?
But you were in love with him, right? So maybe you were trying to protect him. You said you were asleep, but you really saw everything.
Who says that?
He shrugged his shoulders. Everyone around here. They say you nearly got him off. When you went public, gave all those interviews, and said you didn't believe Vargas could have killed anyone, a lot of people believed you. You were pretty convincing, even then.
Well, I didn't get him off, did I?
Only because he pled guilty.
I didn't reply.
I'm sorry, said Hugh. We can talk about something else. I'm just curious, that's all. I always wondered.
Of course you did. He's your father.
But you're not going to tell me any more?
I've already said everything that needs to be said, I told him, and I opened my pocketbook and put down the sun visor so I could touch up my lipstick in the mirror. Thanks for the roses, by the way. Where on earth did you find them?
Roses, he said. What roses?
7. They love a little excitement at the Winthrop Island Club, and don't let them tell you any differently. When Hugh Fisher and I appeared at the entrance of the dining room, arm in arm, he insisted, you could see the disturbance pass from table to table, the way the waves ripple away when you drop a stone into a pond of still water. Quick flickering glances and furtive words and turned shoulders, that kind of thing. People reached for their cocktails and drank. Hugh leaned into my ear.
We're sitting with the Huxleys, by the way. Did I mention that?
Are you certain?
Mrs. Huxley telephoned to beg me an hour ago.
But she didn't know I was coming, too.
I thought it would be a terrific surprise. Come along.
I kept my gaze straight ahead as I walked through that dining room, my arm linked with that of my sturdy young brother, the same way I might at a film premiere or an awards dinner, when everyone's catching a glimpse of you, everyone's examining the cut of your dress and your hair, the color of your lipstick, your posture, your stride, your cleavage, your everything. But this was different. You might encounter a little jealousy in those crowds, a dagger look or two, but the gazes are largely admiring, even worshipful, especially when your husband walks by your side, and he's their most revered of all gods, legend of all legends, whom nobody dares to cross. The families, on the other hand, the members of the Winthrop Island Club, that's a different crowd altogether, the toughest crowd in the world. I don't think a single one of my famous London friends could have got himself into the club, not for $1 million, and especially if he were so gauche as to actually offer $1 million. And this brother of mine, Hugh Fisher Jr., he might possess a great deal of goodwill on the strength of his good looks and his tragic upbringing. The families are nothing if not loyal to their own. But I knew, and he knew, that he was crossing an uncrossable line, as he escorted his notorious half-sister into that dining room overlooking the magnificent links and the cliffs beyond, and the hazy blue sky of a June evening. The difference was, he was enjoying it. I recalled that 18 years ago the Huxleys always ate at the table in the far northwest corner of the room, adjacent to the famous sixth hole, and I'll be damned if my brother didn't steer me in that direction now. Horses in a pasture couldn't have been more habitual, and indeed the fellow who lifted his martini glass as we approached, hiding an expression of horrified astonishment, had something of the look of a horse. Long face, large dark eyes, set a little too far apart, rather like his sister, Livy.
"Hugh,"
he said helplessly, starting to rise, because I was a woman, after all, even if I was that woman.
"Mr. Huxley," said Hugh, "I've brought a little surprise with me. I hope you don't mind. My sister Miranda."
"Miranda? Dick Huxley." I held out my hand.
"Of course I remember Dick very well. You were just 11 or 12 when I last saw you, isn't that right?"
Dick looked at the woman who must have been his wife, and then he looked at me, and at last he reached out one shaking hand and touched mine briefly.
Mrs.
"Just Miranda. We're all friends here, aren't we? Is this your wife?"
Yes, Candy. "Candy, this is...
"I know who it is," the woman said coolly. She was slim and dark-haired, altogether too pretty for Dick Huxley, which meant she wasn't from one of the families. She'd married in, I guessed, on the strength of her looks and her ambition.
"How funny of you to bring her along tonight, Hugh. I'm not sure we have room at the table for her."
God, the nerve of her. I had to admire her nerve. I glanced around the table, which was large and round, laid for 7, one seat empty. I judged plenty of space between settings, but maybe the family liked its elbow room. There were 4 more Huxleys, 2 children, and an older couple that I recognized instantly as the grayed, wrinkled versions of Dr. and Mrs. Huxley, Livy's parents. Mrs. Huxley was looking at her daughter-in-law, wearing an expression of faint approval, and Dr. Huxley was studying the ice in his gin and tonic. The children, aged just below their teens, a boy and a girl, were bouncing from their seats with excitement, bless them.
"Oh, look, your lovely children."
I bent down to look them on the level, the way you absolutely must with young ones.
"Do you know something? You're just about the age your father was when I last saw him." "You're Miranda Thomas, aren't you?" the girl said in awe.
"Can I have your autograph?" asked the boy.
"Children!"
They snapped to attention. Candy Huxley had that look on her face, the rage of a betrayed mother, flushed cheeks and fierce eyes, and now I knew for certain she wasn't from one of the families. They don't do rage. They don't do passion. They drink quietly, copiously, to wash it all out of their systems. I also knew that I wouldn't be forgiven for this small act of seduction, that I had just destroyed any chance of redemption, and maybe I'd done it on purpose. Maybe I wanted to drive myself out of the pale right away, a single stroke, so I wouldn't have to stalk across this damned dining room again in my life. And yet I had come here willingly. I turned to Hugh. "Perhaps we might..."
"What, no room for my sister?" My brother looked directly at Candy. "I see plenty of room.
There's always a place for family, isn't there, Dick?
You, I think.
Dr. Huxley, Mrs. Huxley, I'm sure you remember my sister, Miranda. I'm sure you'd like to welcome her back after all these years.
Mrs. Huxley's face turned to granite. Dr. Huxley frowned at my ear.
I heard a story once, Hugh said. I heard a story that you were one of the first people Miranda met on the island, Dr. Huxley. I think Isabel told me. Old Mr. Silva fell off his boat, and they brought him into my father's house, and you raced over to stitch him back together on the kitchen table.
That was Joseph who saved Mr. Silva, you know, I said. Dove into the water after he fell from his boat. Joseph Vargas. The name dropped like a cannonball into the middle of that table, as I knew it would. And in that instant I realized that everyone around us had gone quiet, that a gargantuan silence filled that dining room as nothing had ever filled it before, at least in my brief experience there. Not a clink of glassware, not a nervy chuckle, not a single roomy cough. Just the smell of perfume and cigarettes, just the strain of 200 ears.
Did he? Said Hugh. Isabel didn't say. How about that?
Candy Huxley turned to her husband.
Dick, say something.
Poor Dick. He fiddled with his napkin and babbled a little.
Now, Hugh, now, let's, you know, Hugh, the Marshalls were just here and,
Hugh, who was more than a decade younger, displayed considerably more composure. He set his hand on Huxley's shoulder and said quietly,
Dick.
And I thought in that second that Hugh Fisher's son and namesake was maybe born for the wrong age, that he would have made an excellent army lieutenant, a leader of men, absolutely certain of himself at the moment of crisis. I thought that his father, whatever his faults, would be terribly proud of this young man, of whose existence he scarcely even knew before he died. I touched my brother's elbow.
You stay and eat, Hugh. I'll just...
No, Miranda. You'll just what, drive home alone? If there's one thing that makes me mad, it's a fellow who won't stand by a lady.
He removed his hand from Huxley's shoulder and took my arm.
We'll both leave. Good night. Ladies, gentlemen.
The words about groaned with irony, but before anybody could stiffen his back at this unspeakable slur, before Hugh could even steer me around for our departure, another voice reached us.
Hugh Fisher! Look at you, young man. Back from school, are you?
I tilted my head to regard the man before me, dressed in the eternal club uniform of jacket and tie and slacks, and I knew he was familiar. I knew that face, that voice, and I can't really say why I didn't immediately recognize him. He recognized me, however. He turned his bland, tanned face toward me and smiled broadly, held out his hand and said,
"Miranda Schuyler, as lovely as ever. You're always welcome at my table."
I took his hand, and the name came out before I even knew it.
"Why, Clay! Clayton Monk! You haven't changed a bit!"
8. I considered this little lie as we sat on the little stone bench overlooking the 8th hole green a couple of hours later, Clay and I, taking in the fragrant, salty twilight as we watched Hugh instruct Clay's pretty daughter Lucy on the art of sinking a long putt. Because, of course, Clay had changed. Everyone changes. And why would you want to stay the same? God knew I wasn't the same round, pink child who had stood on these links 18 years ago to be kissed for the first time. And Clay? Clay was no taut war hero of 26 pining for a wife. Clay had grown a bit of jowl, and his nose was starting to take on the rosy, middle-aged sponginess common to his tribe. And naturally, he had put on weight around the middle. That longed-for wife now stood at the edge of the nearby green, dangling a cigarette, sipping a cocktail, observing their daughter's progress. And I don't mean the golf. All the same, he was still a handsome fellow. He wore his age better than most of the men around here. Maybe he drank less. Maybe he ate less. Maybe he spent more time exercising. He sat, leaning forward, elbows on his knees, and smoked a quiet cigarette. The glass was empty on the bench next to him, but he hadn't gone for more. I gazed across the darkened course, made silver by the rising moon, and the monumental rambling clubhouse to our right, and I thought that maybe I hadn't lied that much after all, that Clay remained the same in everything essential. Certainly the club was the same. The island itself had altered by not one hair in 18 years. I said this aloud to Clay.
"I guess you're right," he said. "Summer after summer, we stick to our ways around here. It's our own world."
"That's the appeal of an island, I suppose. You get to evolve all by yourselves, like Madagascar, or not evolve at all." Clay gestured with a cigarette toward the nearby mansion.
"That's going to change, though. Did you hear? We're finally going to build a new clubhouse."
"A new clubhouse? Why?"
"Well, look at it. It's a dinosaur. Too big, too grand, too expensive to keep up."
"Too expensive? Haven't you got all the money in the world?"
"Oh, we're just thrifty New Englanders at heart. That old place was never really our style. We're not Newport, after all. Nobody's here to show off."
"Still, it seems like a waste. It's not that old, is it? It only went up in the 20s. And didn't some famous architect design it?"
"Well, it's too late now. The contract's signed. At the end of the season, Tom Donnelly is going to knock it down and build us something smaller, a little less flashy, a family sort of place."
"I hope he's got a big enough wrecking ball. It's going to take weeks. Wouldn't it be easier just to blow it up?"
"Residents won't have it. It's in the contract. He's got to dismantle it piece by piece, without explosives or fire or wrecking balls or anything like that. He wasn't too pleased, but he wanted the contract." Clay paused to smoke. "A good man, Tom Donnelly."
"I never met him."
"He lives down at your end of the island, a year-rounder. Does most of the construction work around here. People trust him."
I stared at the yellow-lit clubhouse, as gargantuan and indiscreet as they come, turrets and gables and half-timbering, a vast cliché of old English vernacular, and I supposed he was right. It was the kind of architecture that pretended to old age, a false birth certificate, a pedigree where none existed. And the islanders didn't need that kind of clubhouse. They had their own pedigrees. Clay coughed and went on.
"If you're thinking of making any repairs at Greyfriars while you're there, fixing the place up a bit, I mean, he's the right fella to call. I'd be happy to introduce you. The house could use some work."
"Yes, I noticed."
"Your poor mother. Left without any money. First the taxes on the estate and the mortgages. She had to sell the New York apartment, not that she ever lived there. And then the Fisher Company stock. I told her to sell it all, but she had this faith."
He shook his head.
"Hugh Fisher. He sure knew how to spend money, that fellow. Remember that damned yacht of his? 20 crew, all on salary? That was the first thing she sold after he died. And even that just went toward the tax bill."
"Were the taxes so bad?"
77%. She had to sell everything she could, and all she had left was the Fisher stock. She lived on the dividends until those went dry, and a year later the whole company went bankrupt, and she had just about nothing to live on. Terrible situation. We'd help out if we could, but she'd never take it. You, on the other hand."
"Me?"
"You could fix things up while you're here. I think she'd appreciate it. She's done everything she could to hang on to Greyfriars, because of your father. She wants to keep it for young Hugh."
"It's going to cost an awful lot of money to fix up Greyfriars," I said. "It's fallen to pieces almost."
"Well, but I don't mean to be vulgar, but—"
"You can be vulgar with me, Clay. We're old friends."
"Well, surely money's no trouble. That husband of yours, he's made a lot of movies, hasn't he?"
Yes, of course," I said. "He certainly has."
"I'd be happy to put you in touch with Donnelly. He's a good man."
"Please do."
"It would give you something to do while you're here, a project. I know we're a little dull here on the island for a movie star like you."
I returned my attention to the three figures on the green, and to Clay's wife, languid in the moonlight. She was not beautiful, too long-nosed and sharp-boned, but she didn't need to be beautiful, did she? "So you married Livy Huxley," I said. "I hadn't heard."
"Yes, I did. 16 years now, can you believe it?"
"No, I can't. I really can't." There was a terrible pause. Livy's giggle carried across the grass, Hugh's patient murmur.
Clay said, "Well, a fella's gotta marry somebody."
He paused lengthily while we both digested the meaning in that sentence, and whether it required further explanation, and whether I had a right to hear that explanation. Apparently he decided I did, because when he spoke again, his voice had lowered to a burr.
"I waited a year for Izzy to come around, but she didn't. She wouldn't. Then Livy, I don't know. After a while, it just seemed right. We've been happy. She's been a good wife, a good mother."
"You have two other daughters, isn't that right? I think that's what she said."
"Yep, Jacqueline and Barbara. They're back home with the nanny. Livy doesn't want them having dinner at the club until they're ready."
"That's sensible. We can't have kids running amok at cocktail hour."
He laughed briefly. "No, we can't. Anyway, the old gods had enough excitement for one evening. Can you believe Dick Huxley? He's always been a damn sissy. That wife of his."
"It wasn't just Dick. They were all against us. Me, I should say."
"Not all of them. Maybe not even most of them. They're good people, you know. But when a few people set their minds against you, well..."
He lifted his cigarette.
"Anyway, like I said, you're welcome at our table. Hugh's a solid young man. We've always liked him around here."
I looked across the 10 or 15 yards to the green, where Hugh was shaking his head, laughing, taking the club from Lucy's inept hands. I said, "He's a terrific kid. I wish I'd had the chance to know him sooner."
"You know, Miranda, I've looked on him like a son. I've tried to treat him like one. It's a bum hand he was dealt, and only the women to raise him. They sent him to the local school for years, until a few of us got up the nerve to, well, the thing is, we took up a collection. Don't tell your mother. She thinks it was a scholarship, that St. Paul's thought he showed a lot of promise. Well, he did. He's a smart kid, but that wasn't it. We just didn't want him to fall through, you know? So he could go to the right school, meet the right people."
"Of course. The right people are so important."
"Don't, Miranda. Don't be like that. They're decent people. You never got to know them, that's all. Livy's dad, you know what he did? He was 45 when the war started, and he convinced the Army Board to give him a commission. He spent 2 years in Europe, Miranda, 2 years. First as a battlefield medic, then a base hospital surgeon. 45 years old with a wife and kids, and he landed on the beaches on D-Day and spent the next 48 hours amputating arms and legs and whatever else. For 2 days he didn't sleep. He won't talk about it, but it's true."
"I didn't know that."
"You have to understand how shook up people were when it happened. What happened to your stepfather, I mean. And there you were, giving interviews, talking publicly about the whole thing, defending Vargas."
"I was only telling the truth. I only wanted justice."
"You don't think he killed Mr. Fisher?"
"I didn't say that. I just think, whatever happened, it wasn't Joseph's fault. It couldn't have been."
"Whatever happened?"
Clay finished his cigarette and crushed it out carefully on the bench, dropped the stub in the empty glass. Bad form to leave cigarette butts on the sacred course, I supposed.
"I always thought you were the one who could answer that, Miranda."
"I already have. I told the police everything I knew." He placed his hands on the edge of the bench and leaned back a little.
"It divided the whole island. The locals thought one thing, the summer families thought another thing. I don't think anyone's gotten over it. We come here to relax, you know, to escape things like that. Murders and what have you. To live quietly. And the whole thing happens and you're in the middle of it. And maybe they could have forgiven you for that. I mean, it wasn't your fault. You were just a kid. But when you talked, Miranda, when you spoke to the newspapers, that was the real crime. You know, murdering someone is one thing, but talking to the newspapers?"
He made a cutting motion to his throat. "I didn't want to, but nobody would listen. Everybody just wanted the whole thing to go away, Joseph to go away.
And now he's escaped from prison. Christ, he's got some nerve, I'll say that."
"Nobody knows where he is?"
"I don't know, Miranda. Maybe you can tell me the answer to that."
I spread my hands. "I'm afraid I can't." There was a fractional pause, and then Clay leaned his head back and chuckled.
"Damn it all, Miranda, listen to you. Anybody'd think you were an islander now. Well, maybe you were right to stay away."
It's done wonders for you. Ah, Miranda, a movie star. Say, where's that husband of yours? I'd like to meet that fellow. He's a genius.
Back in London, I'm afraid.
Is he going to pay us a visit? Or maybe you're not staying that long.
I turned to face him. The lights from the club just reached his face, and for a moment it seemed I was facing him 18 years ago, and we were both still kids, in love with other people. Can you do me a favor, Clay?
Anything.
Let's not mention my husband. In fact, let's not mention anything. I'd rather the whole world didn't know I was here this summer, if you know what I mean.
Something wrong?
I put my hand around his elbow. Just spread the word for me, please. I know they don't like me, but...
Clay shook his head and laughed. Nobody's going to rat on you, trust me. This is the island we're talking about.
I considered the expression on his face, and I turned my head to consider Livy, who had finished her cigarette and set her empty glass on the edge of the green, and now stood between Hugh's arms in her short, dark cocktail dress, nested together like two spoons, his hands wrapped around her hands, wrapped around the handle of the club. Livy was giggling, and so was Lucy, standing at Hugh's left elbow, and Hugh was imploring them both to be serious. A delicate business, putting a golf ball. You couldn't laugh and putt at the same time, not if you wanted to sink the ball in the hole.
Yes, I know, I said. That's why I came here.
Clay reached into his pocket and lit another cigarette, rather slowly, because his attention lay also on the scene before us. I smelled the warm, pungent smoke, the comfortable bite of whiskey that clung to him. The wind blew in cool Canadian gusts from the northwest, making me shiver a little, and Clay must have noticed because he took off his jacket without a word and laid it over my shoulders. Anyway, he said, returning to his old position, flicking the ash from the tip of his cigarette.
You know the last thing anyone wants around here is a bunch of newspapermen pitching tents on the grass again. Brings down the tone.
I'll say, almost as bad as a United States Marshal. We sat there without speaking. Livy sank her putt at last, and it was Lucy's turn. Clay's hand crept under the hem of the jacket and clasped my hand.
How is she, Izzy?
She's fine. At first I thought she'd changed completely. You wouldn't recognize her. And then I thought maybe she's just who she always was, who she always wanted to be. But maybe I'm wrong.
You'll tell her hello for me?
I gave Clay's hand a last squeeze, stood up, and removed his jacket from my shoulders. As I turned to hand it back to him, he was rising too. Clayton Monk would never remain seated in a woman's presence. I saw how bereft he looked, how vulnerable in the indigo twilight. So I kissed his cheek and spoke softly. I think maybe you should tell her yourself sometime. 9. We drove home an hour later, Hugh and I, under a watchful moon. As we passed the sentry gate that marked the private eastern end of the island, there was never a sentry, it was just for show, I turned to Hugh and said, "So Clay Monk married Livy Huxley. You know he was engaged to Isabel once."
"No way, are you serious? Mr. Monk and Isabel?"
"He was desperately in love with her that summer. She was such a minx. She kept breaking it off and then taking him back."
"Really?"
he laughed.
"Old Isabel was a manslayer, huh? You wouldn't guess now."
"Well, she's changed a great deal since those days."
"I'll say. Man, oh man, Isabel and Mr. Monk."
"Don't tell her I told you. I think she's put all of those things behind her, the things that used to belong to her."
"Yeah, she's good at that."
Without warning, he slammed on the brakes and veered off the road into one of the giant meadows adjoining the sea. I braced myself on the dashboard and screamed, "What the hell are you doing?"
"Sorry." He threw the car into park and switched off the engine. "Come on. I want to show you something."
"You might have warned me." Poor boy. He was still so young. He didn't know what I meant. What it was like to have brakes squeal and wheels swerve so soon after experiencing a terrible smash-up like I had experienced. The papers had kept it quiet, of course. My husband had seen to that. He'd made sure that the nurses in the hospital hadn't talked, and the doctors hadn't talked, and the police hadn't talked. Not one detail had crept out into that vast, teeming, insatiable public curiosity, such that I sometimes wondered if it had really happened at all, whether I'd dreamt the whole evening. Then I looked down at my flat stomach, the way my dress hung from my hips, and I knew it wasn't a dream. I sat in the passenger seat of Hugh's Ford convertible, catching my breath and my nerves, while Hugh got out and went around to open my door.
"Say, you're all right, aren't you? I didn't stop too fast."
I took his hand and lifted myself out of the car. "Quite all right. Just what did you have in mind?"
"You'll see."
He stuffed his hands in his trouser pockets and started off to the east, toward the sea. The field had been recently mowed, the hay gathered up and baled, and the smell of dry, warm grass lay everywhere. I couldn't remember who owned it. Some local farmer, I thought, not one of the families. But maybe it had changed hands since then. Maybe I was mistaken. The stubble scratched my shoes and my delicate stockings. I called out to Hugh to wait a minute while I took everything off, stuffed stockings into shoes, and he obeyed me, though I could see he was impatient, animated, all covered in silver by the moon, hands twitching in his pockets. My feet were too tender, and the rough grass hurt the soles as I walked, but I welcomed the pain. It was good to feel things again, to experience a pain that you had inflicted on yourself with conscious intent. In any case, it didn't last long. The field was narrow, maybe 200 yards from road to sea, and the end came abruptly. My toes encountered pebbles among the grass, then rocks. Hugh stopped, and I stopped, and when I looked up, there it was, dark and still except for a long white path cast by the moon. The sea. We stood on a little ridge about 15 feet up. Below us, the waves washed gently along a small U-shaped beach.
"The islanders call it Horseshoe Beach," said Hugh. "Want to climb down?"
"Why not?" He clambered down the rocks a bit and turned, hand outstretched, to help me. I grasped his fingers for balance, because the rocks were damp, but my bare feet gripped the surface pretty well. I curled my toes into the granite and felt rather strong. The last jump into the sand, I released my brother's hand and let fly, dropped my shoes, ran straight into the edge of the surf and splashed around while he stripped off his own shoes and socks and rolled up his trousers to wade in beside me.
"Now I know you're my sister," he said.
"I always was."
"Don't you love this place? Nobody ever comes here. You can't get in so easy from the road, and you can't just walk over from the other beaches. You'd have to sail in, or row."
I looked from side to side and saw the curve of the inlet, the two opposite points covered in rocks, and a chill passed over me.
"I see what you mean. You'd have to know it was there."
Hugh was kicking around at an incoming wave.
"I like to come here to be alone, you know, sit and think. Sometimes I take my boat out at night and sail right in, and it's like I'm the only person in the world."
"I like that feeling, too," I smiled at him. "What do you think about?"
"Oh, you know."
"No, I don't know. I wish I did."
"What do you like to think about, Hugh? What kind of books do you read? What do you like to study at school?"
"Me? Everything, sis. I want to read it all. I want to play it all, see it all, that world out there." He waved his hand.
"What's it like?"
"It's pretty grand sometimes, but sometimes it disappoints you, too. People disappoint you."
"Who's disappointed you?"
"Not you, that's for sure," I said. "I liked the way you stood up to Dick Huxley. Not a lot of boys your age would stick up for their sisters like that." He shrugged.
"What else was I going to do? Anyway, we had a good time with the monks, didn't we?"
I nearly opened my mouth to say what I really thought, that the monks, while decent to invite us back into the Pale, were also about as scintillating in their dinner conversation as a lump of tapioca pudding, before I remembered that my brother was, after all, only 17.
"I'm sure we did," I said.
"One monk in particular seemed to be enjoying your company."
"Lucy."
"Ah," he kicked again, ducked his head.
"She's a good sport."
"She's very pretty."
"She's all right."
"She's how old? 15?
"I guess so, 15 last February."
"She certainly enjoyed her golf lesson," I said, and I added silently, "as her mother did." Hugh bent to pick up a stone and send it skidding across the surface of the water, which was placid this evening. More lake